Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
And with us today, we have John Galloway. John is member of the .NET community team and executive director of the .NET Foundation. Welcome, John.
Hi, glad to join you.
So, John, first and foremost, what is the .NET Foundation?
It's a good question. And honestly, until joining the .NET Foundation, I wouldn't have given you a very good answer myself. The high level, like, you know, the tweet length description is it's an organization to support open source .NET. You know, unpacking that a bit, it has two real jobs. One is it's a common place for companies and people to work together on the same software code, the same code base. So .NET used to just be Microsoft, but now .NET's a lot bigger. We've got Google, Samsung, Red Hat, you know, Unity, a lot of people using and contributing to the source code, not just companies, but people too. We need a common way where everyone can work on the same code base and feel safe that they're going to keep the rights to it, that the source code's not going to go away, that kind of thing. Now, whenever someone at Microsoft, you know, they're paid by Microsoft, but they're contributing code to the .NET Foundation. So every commit they do is actually contributed to the .NET Foundation. And if you look at the copyrights on any of the repos, it'll say copyright .NET Foundation. Same for someone at Google or Samsung. Same for, you know, any of the community contributors. When they contribute code, their pull request is accepted, that is also copyright now, .NET Foundation. So that's kind of item number one. It's important. It's a big step in .NET being more than just Microsoft. Item number two is kind of less known, and I think it's also pretty important. And that is, our goal is to keep open source projects healthy and alive. And that includes not just core CLR and these big ticket items, but includes things like AutoMapper, Akka.NET, CakeBuild, some of these projects that are, you know, identity server, projects that a lot of people are using on and want to rely on, companies want to invest in, but they want to make sure that these projects are able to stay around and stay healthy. So one of the saddest things for me as a developer is when I look, you know, I have a problem, I find a library and I look at the last commit and it was 2 years ago and there's 18 pending pull requests, you know, and so we try and do things to make that not happen.
So does the .NET Foundation, the support that they offer to make, you know, to help keep the projects alive, is that monetary support, or do they maybe like point developers at doing hot fixes and patches and software improvement, or how are they actually helping these open source projects?
Yeah, great question. So it can be monetary, but it's not usually a lot of money. We don't, you know, when people think of, like, we do get some funding for marketing, but in terms of like buckets of how much money we get, we're not marketing level money. You know what I mean? We're foundation level. So we can support projects with things like buying code signing certificates, you know, things that are blockers to them. That's kind of the level more of where we're financially contributing. A lot of it more is about setting up infrastructure and practices. So as part of joining .NET Foundation, we work with the projects to get set up with things like CLA agreements. So that's contributor license agreements, so that everything is kind of checked in and handled. We do things like legal support when they need it. There's several enterprise kind of accounts we have, like AppVeyor for builds, code signing services, so that, you know, their check-ins are automatically built and code signed, ready for delivery. Another thing, which is one of those things that you don't normally think of, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, that. How do you share passwords in an open source project team? And a lot of the time that's like shooting passwords over Slack, or maybe it's a shared Dropbox, you know, something. It's not usually enterprise, you know, it's not the best. So we have things like an enterprise LastPass account. And so when projects join, we set them all up there in their own group. And that's a safe, secure way to share passwords and handles, you know, all the things LastPass does, like key rotation and stuff like that. So, you know, that's sort of the level of things. When I was talking it through with Hanselman for a presentation I did once, he described it almost as kind of like, you've seen the progression of like there's infrastructure as a service going to, you know, a platform as a service to like functions as a service, right? And you want to write as little code. You want to write the code that impacts, but you don't want to have to make all these little, you don't want to be managing subnets and all that stuff, right? And then I've seen another people have done this, an illustration using like pizza as a service. And there's the whole like, you go shop for all the ingredients, prepare the pizza, cook the pizza, put it on the table, set the table, serve the drinks, all that. That's doing all the work. And then you can go up to buying a pre-made pizza and just heat it up and throw it on the table, down to you go out to a restaurant, right? So it's a similar sort of progression there of, we want open source developers to the most important things that you can be doing is thinking strategically, fixing bugs, you know, accepting pull requests, making releases, like that sort of stuff. You shouldn't have to spend your time, you know, setting up a service or dealing with issues about who owns this code or that sort of thing. So a lot of it is kind of looking at cross-cutting concerns that affect all these projects and trying to solve that, you know, one time for a lot of people.
So looking at the list of businesses involved in the technical steering group, looks like there's a lot of big names, of course, Microsoft, Red Hat, JetBrains, Unity, Samsung, and Google. It seems like all of these companies also buying into this model that it's very important to keep these projects alive. What's the appeal to getting these organizations behind this foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, I can't speak for them, but I can tell you a general theme that I hear across. One is, yes, they've invested. All these companies have invested from a business perspective in .NET. It's important for them that .NET stays around, stays healthy. They want a say in where .NET is going. So these are they're members of the technical steering group. So that means, you know, we talk about long-range plans for .NET, and they propose things like, you know, working groups. As an example, I was John Skeet is our representative from Google, and he was on a technical steering group call last week, and he proposed a white paper on something that was not well enough specified. So that's a perfect example there. So that's one thing, and then the other thing I believe is to be able to say yes, we're serious about .NET to kind of convey to their developer audience that it's not just a gimmick or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's kind of a statement of intent from them as well.
So what are the number of projects underneath the umbrella of the .NET Foundation?
Oh gosh, I should have this number and I honestly don't. And the reason that it's a little bit harder than you'd think I'm actually looking, but so there's roughly 35-ish. If you look on our projects page, you'll see 500 repositories, but remember, we break things down by a lot of different, you know, all these, like just the ASP.NET organization has tons of repos, right? So if you look out on GitHub/.NET, there's an area where you can go in and so it's GitHub.NET/home, and there's a list of projects we've got in there. So it's broken down by a lot of different ones, you know, and there's a huge range. There's a lot of frameworks. There are things like, you know, testing frameworks, things that are commonly widely used, XUnit as an example, and all the way to, you know, like Orchard is an example of something that people are building on top of as a content management solution. So there's a pretty wide range, but I would say that a lot of it goes to, there's a good amount that are, you know, .NET Core. This is the .NET framework. And then building on top of it to kind of common build testing types of systems, that sort of things.
How does a project become part of the .NET Foundation? Are they recognized by the foundation and then asked to join, or is there some kind of petitioning process that they could do to become part of the foundation?
Yeah, so on the .NET Foundation site, we've got a thing in there where it says kind of like, here's how you go, here's how you get involved, here's how you join the project. And so I have reached out to some where I've said, like, for instance, Automapper. I pinged Jimmy Bogard on Twitter and said, hey, you guys thought about joining .NET Foundation. So jumped on a Skype call and did most of the work there. There are a few steps to it. And the general kind of process is, you know, number one, they ping .NET Foundation, which is basically filling in a short little form and it goes into a queue. And often they have to ping me because I should say I'm the executive director of the .NET Foundation. I'm also basically the only full-time person working on .NET Foundation. So I get a backlog. And so, you know, sometimes it's, hey, John, what's going on with this? So there's a checklist that we've got, which is just a markdown file that people will usually create an issue on, you know, in their GitHub repo. So that's an example of, hey, have you considered, what is your process for someone becoming a committer? What is your process for, you know, do you have, you know, specific plans? It basically says, like, are you at a mature point where you're ready to, you know, to do this? Because in order for someone to join, they have to have some sort of process in place for a lot of things. There's also a 3 or 4 page, you know, Word document form where they go through and fill in, you know, who's the contact numbers, who are your main contributors. So we go through, we get that kind of information together. Then I run it by the advisory council, and .NET Foundation has two kind of groups that we work with. One is the advisory council, which is some folks that are just experienced in the .NET open source community. For instance, you know, we have people from GitHub, we have some MVPs, we have some people that advise because they know .NET open source. So I'll send a list usually. I'll say, the following four projects have applied to join .NET Foundation. What do you think? I recommend them. What do you think? And then there'll be sometimes some discussion. They'll say, oh yeah, I love this project, or I've heard some things that there's some, you know, fights between the two, you know, leads of this project. Maybe check on that first, or, you know, that kind of thing. It's funny, but it's important, because I've had projects where you get most of the way through and then you send out a document and one of them won't sign, or, you know, there's issues that need to be worked out before people contribute. So that's kind of the advisory process. Once that's ready, I send them to the board of directors. And the board of directors, there's three people on board of directors, and they're listed on the website. Currently, it's Scott Hunter, Miguel de Acasa, and Rachel Reese. And then I'll say, here's my recommendation. And we basically, they give their recommendation or don't, you know, we have some discussion about it. Once that's done, we're ready to announce whenever the project is ready to. There's one other step in there that I forgot, which is important. The board gives their approval. Then we have actually a contribution document, and it's a, you know, legal agreement. We send it out over DocuSign, and it basically says, you know, they're signing that they are contributing their code to the .NET Foundation. Once that's done, once the document's signed, then we can announce it. And there's still some other, like, usually we'll do some other things after that where we'll do some setup stuff, but we're ready once the document's signed to go ahead and announce it. And some of the things that we do afterwards are things like setting up the CLA, if they have any services we need to get them signed up on. You know, we have a .NET Foundation admin account on GitHub that we request joins their GitHub organization as an owner. And this is for things like, hey, what happens if, you know, the contributors say, hey, I'm done with this project, do what you want with it. Okay, now we need to be able to bring people on, you know, so, or to help administrate things on their behalf.
So how else can people get involved? Are there opportunities for the general public, developers to contribute, or is it just find some of these projects on GitHub, go ahead and pull down the code, submit pull requests and things, or are there other opportunities to get involved?
Yeah, I've been trying to think about how we can bridge that more and connect this kind of off their foundation and these big companies and these big projects with, you know, day-to-day open source and day-to-day .NET development. I've been inspired by some recent talks that I've seen lately. There's Sean Colleen did a really good talk at .NET Fringe on a wider .NET, and he talked about how we can kind of build this software maturity model. And he launched a site, awider.net, which is just kind of some thoughts on how we can do some things. He's encouraging some involvement there. And then also Ian Cooper did a great talk on a .NET Renaissance at NDC Oslo, or yeah, it was NDC Oslo this summer. So, and he talked about, here's where I'd like to see things going. These are things where really the community, to get to the next level, I agree with both of them that the community needs to kind of take some steps to jump into this. I tried to encourage some of that. I just, we did this July 24th through September 1st. I launched this kind of first year attempt at this thing I called .NET Summer Hackfest. And you can see some recent things on our blog on the .NET Foundation. That's .NETFoundation.org. And then also I set up a kind of status page on it, aka.ms/.NET Summer. So those are some projects where we said, hey, let's take some projects that are willing to host open source, you know, 2-week sprint open source hackfest. They kind of would put some beginner friendly or new to our project friendly issues up and say, come on and join us. We'll help get you started. We'll have, you know, Gitter conversations running. In some cases, we've got like MVVM Cross is doing two big in-person events in Amsterdam because a lot of their contributors are in Amsterdam. And then the recent one we had events in both Prague and London. But then a lot of contributors just around the world. One of the first ones we did, we had our two main contributors. I believe one was from London and one was from India. And it was just really cool to see this all around the world working together, you know? And so that's, this was a first attempt at it. I'm hoping to do this bigger next summer and kind of continue doing more of these. But I do feel like this is something where I'm trying to kind of talk to people about what does the .NET Foundation do. And I'm hoping some of that starts discussion where people will say, oh, well, you say you do this, why aren't you doing this? Or can you help out this project? They could probably use some help or that kind of thing. And, you know, we've been doing a few things and, you know, we're trying to look at things like, for instance, there's this Open Collective. Open Collective is a system where they will handle finances for nonprofits and user groups and things. And so, you know, could the .NET Foundation do some things like that where we're, again, infrastructure behind the scenes? So, yeah, I'd love to see more and more involvement and discussion. We have some forums out on .NET Foundation. I'm out on Twitter and always open for thoughts and advice and ideas.
Recently, there's been a big announcement of the next release of .NET Core 2.0. What are the most exciting things from your perspective about the latest update, latest release?
I'm excited about it. I've been messing with .NET Core since it was Project K, you know, and I would get these random. So I sometimes stay up way too late at night, as some developers do. And somebody I know that stays up even later is David Fowler on the ASP.NET team. And sometimes I'll get chats from him. And that's usually my indication that I've stayed up way too late. It'll be 3 a.m. and it'll be like, dude, check this out. And he'll send me a gist or he'll send me a link to something. And I'll be like, or send me a screenshot. I'm like, how does that even compile, or what are you doing? You know, so I've watched it grow, and .NET, I feel like .NET Core has really kind of matured with this 2.0 release. There were a lot of things where I was excited about it when we hit the 1.0 and 1.1 releases, but then I would talk to companies and they would say, well, I can't use it because I need this API or I need this thing. So 2.0 is really the big push for that, was .NET standard and API support, and make it so that people can really invest and that their code will port forward pretty cleanly. So definitely that kind of ability to port your existing code, to take your existing, you know, so that you're not having to start from scratch. An example where I saw this work actually was with our .NET Summer Hackfest. Our first thing we did was with Keen.io, and they have an event logging platform. And it has, they have a free level up to, like, you can log, I think it's up to like 20 million events in a month. So it's pretty substantial what you can do for free. And then they have paid level over that. And they want to take, they had a bunch of portable class libraries, you know, and a complicated solution. and it was difficult to maintain and all that. And so they said, hey, could we port this to .NET Standard? And so we did in 2 weeks. They did. I kind of helped get them on some phone calls when they got stuck. But basically, we saw at the end of it that they're running on .NET Standard, CI builds, all their tests, everything running, Windows, Mac, Linux, you know, and they went from all these different PCLs and complicated thing to one .NET Standard library. So that's the big, big selling point. There's a lot of other neat things, but that's the big ticket item in .NET Core 2.
So for those companies and organizations that like to wait for even numbered releases,
right?
This is the next one, right? So this is their opportunity to go ahead and make the adoption and make the switch.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. On both sides of it, I've worked in enterprise, I've worked in financial companies, I remember when .NET 2, not .NET Core, but .NET 2 shipped, and I was like, come on, guys, when can we get on this? This is the one, you know, and I do feel like this is a pretty solid time. I feel like earlier I would be excited about, you know, .NET Core, and I'd say, hey, why don't you do this? When the company would say, like, do you recommend that? Should we do that? And once I dug in, I'd be like, oh, I think it's cool, but I don't know if it'll work for you, you know? So I feel like this is kind of the big time, you know? There's a natural thing where a lot of companies won't even think about it until 1.0 ships. And then once 1.0 ships, then they'll do a prototype and then they'll give you their first real feedback is when the 1.0 ships, you know? So it's all kind of like a history repeats with pretty much any software. It's like, once the 1.0 ships, then you get the real feedback from the big companies. And then, you know, 2.0 is kind of the consolidation of that, of those issues. And there's a lot of other big stuff that's in Core 2.0. There's definitely some huge performance enhancements. There's some simplicity on platforms, like the way that the Linux support is done and Docker's, the way Docker images ship has gotten smoother. There's even just things like, before, getting .NET Core running on Mac, it was difficult because you needed to open SSL through Homebrew or however else you wanted to get it. You could get into weird states where it was a pain to get it running. And now that's basically done natively. And you don't need that separate OpenSSL, you know, dependency. So there's just a lot of like these things where it's like, wouldn't it be nice if, and it's like, yeah, that's done. And then one other thing, just while I'm rambling about fun new things, I like, and I was conflicted at first, but ASP.NET Core 2 has Razor Pages support. And the idea there was, do I really need, if you do file new project and create an MVC application, you've got some things that look a little weird. You've got home controller, and then you look at the three actions, and it's like home, index, and contact, I believe. And they all basically say return view. Like, that's all they do, you know? And so it's like, why do I have a controller that's, you know, with a view and there's no models? Why is this really MVC for just this simple case? I do definitely like, you know, having grown up as a developer through, you know, classic ASP and PHP and those sorts of things, I love having MVC available when I need it, but I don't want to always use it. So so the idea with Razor Pages is you can do this single Razor page, and it's got you've got the ability, it's running on top of MVC. So you've got kind of those, all the primitives that you need if you ever needed it, if you ever need them, but you don't have to use them to start with. So I can literally just drop in a new CSHTML file, put some Razor markup in it or just HTML, and it's good to go. That's kind of it's a progression from, we used to have ASP.NET web pages. It was a step in this direction, but the problem was it was a totally different world. So you didn't have what they call a grow-up story. You would write, if you wrote some, you know, if you had maybe a few of these Razor pages and they start getting more and more complex, you end up, it's pretty difficult to abstract it and make it better. You end up having to rewrite it probably. And so this is kind of a nice, the advantage of those, but you're running on top of the whole MVC platform if you need.
Excellent.
Yeah. I was just working on something last night with this and I was like, okay, I need to add this one view. Okay, here I go. Add a controller. And I was like, wait a minute. I'll just drop in a page. Boom, solid. You know, it was all set. So.
So you can transition fairly easily from just a web page with some code inside the page to a MVC style page?
You can. There's a little bit of a different programming model for the way they've got it set up. The Razor code transfers like basically right away. The code behind that's by default there for a Razor page is more of kind of an event-based thing. It almost feels a little bit more like, okay, so don't shoot me or don't jump to conclusions, but it sounds a little bit like web forms a bit more because you have an event where it's like on get, on post, on, so it's not, they're not hooked to controls, but they are hooked to events. It's more of kind of a little bit more of an MVVM style where you can very easily in your code behind for a Razor page, you can have your model there as well. It's your page model. So this handles some things where you always run into a problem with MVC where you really shouldn't be exposing your models directly to your output. You should have a response model or a view model, right? And so this makes it a little easier to kind of have that view model type of abstraction in there.
Is Razor Pages only for core, or is it also available in the latest update of the regular .NET framework?
It is it's in ASP.NET Core. ASP.NET Core can run on both just .NET Core or on .NET Full Framework. So either does work, but it is a feature of ASP.NET Core.
Yeah, it sounds like there's still some confusion in the industry as to the differences between the .NET Core terminology, .NET Core versus .NET Standard. What exactly that encompasses and what that means. Can you just give us a brief description or the defining characteristics?
Oh, no, the audio is cutting out. I have to go. Sorry, phone call. Yeah, it is complicated. And we don't do ourselves any favors with naming, definitely at Microsoft. And so we've got let's talk about frameworks first. We've got the .NET Full Framework, and this is the framework that we're kind of used to. It installs only on Windows. It's the, monolithic install. There's basically one install on your machine, that is the .NET framework install. And it includes some things like desktop app support and, WPF and some legacy things in there that go back for quite a while. So that's .NET Full Framework. Then there's .NET Core, which is lightweight, cross-platform, fully open source. And that's kind of a new, newer thing. And then you've got applications that you build on top can target both of those. So I could run an ASP.NET Core application, and I can say this is targeting, .NET Core. And when I do that, then it's going to say, okay, well, because of that, I'm not going to let you run Windows only print driver specific whatever sort of stuff, right? Or if I do need those sorts of APIs, then I need to target .NET Full Framework. So that's kind of the framework level thing. But then you get into, well, that's complicated. How do I, I would prefer instead of knowing which APIs are in which and all that, because there's not just .NET Full Framework and .NET Core. We've also got Xamarin. We've got Mono out there. We've got UWP. So there's actually a lot of different places .NET code can run. So if you remember back a ways, we had a problem like this with browsers, right? Every browser had different features, and we said, wow, it would be nice if we had some standards. You can joke about it. Not everything's perfect, but for the most part, the whole standards movement with HTML really worked pretty well. I mean, if you look at like HTML5, for the most part, it's much more of a solved problem. Like, I don't have to worry about my code running nice on one browser and looking poorly on another, if I'm coding to standards, right? So the idea with .NET Standard is it's a standard. Think of it like HTML5 standard or, some of the other standards out there. So what we'll say is, okay, if you target this number standard, it includes these APIs and it will run on these platforms. So in the future, let's say there's a new, you know, I don't know, HoloLens drone, whatever, you know, platform out there. And they say, we support .NET Core 2 and better. Well, if my code targeted, or excuse me, if they say we support .NET Standard 2 and better. So then if my code supports .NET Standard, boom, it just automatically lights up. I don't have to recompile. I don't have to create a new portable class library. I don't have to do anything. So that's kind of really the .NET Standard selling point is, if you're, especially if you're writing like a library, if you're writing any kind of code that you would like to be portable, NuGet packages especially, you want to write those for .NET Standard. And then anyone that wants to use them doesn't have to, all they need to know is my platform require, you know, supports this level of .NET Standard and your library supports that level of .NET Standard, we're good to go.
Yeah, so best practices and recommendations, if you're doing something for public consumption, target standard. If you're looking for something maybe internal that you have control over the environment, or maybe necessarily require something that's only available in the latest core release, would that be fair to say?
I would say pretty much, but I would take it a little further. I would say, if at all possible, just target .NET Standard. If what you're doing can work on .NET Standard, do that, because it's going to, you're not going to later have to recompile to support some new platform. You're not going to need to, you know what I mean? It's a more standards-based way of doing things. And as far as which level of .NET Standard, I've heard some interesting questions lately. Like somebody said, now that .NET Standard 2 is out, does that mean you're deprecating .NET Standard 1.6 or whatever? Right? And you really want to think of it more like each new standard number that comes out includes all the previous and more. So there's different ways to look at it. One is you can say, look at the superset of all the APIs that you want to support on all your platforms and say, okay, to support all these APIs, that means I need this number of API or of .NET Standard. Or you can say, basically what you want to do is target the lowest number, the lowest .NET Standard number that your code will run on, because that's going to open you up to the most platforms.
Yeah, to me, that's like programming to an IEnumerable instead of an ILIST. If you don't need the interface for an ILIST, don't use it.
Perfect. Yeah, and David Fowler has a really nice explanation of this he wrote up that they linked to from the .NET Standard repo, where he kind of spells that out. And he does it exactly as you're saying, where he talks about different, you know, class level support. And if your mind thinks more that way, it's like, boom, oh, this totally makes sense. So I've talked to a lot of people where they'll look at the charts and the docs and they'll say, I don't get it. And then they look at the code that David wrote up. That's exactly what you're saying. And it's like, oh yeah, okay, I get this.
So another exciting item upcoming is the .NET Conf. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, .NET Conf is it's September 19th through 21st. So it is a, you know, it's .NET is helping to put it on, and it's being run through Channel 9 Studio. We've got some great, I think we're very soon to be announcing with all the speakers. You can see it at .netconf.net. And so it's a 3-day event, and it's going to include, you know, product teams talking, community presentations. The third day, I believe, is a full kind of beginner getting started course. So that's pretty neat. And then it's also, like I said, it's supported by .NET Foundation, and you can see that on the site we're sponsored by, you know, of course, Microsoft, but also .NET Foundation, Red Hat, Google, Soliance, Samsung, and Dev Intersection. So kind of a broad thing. And that's just in general, that's more what we're trying to do with things is, hey, this is .NET is bigger than Microsoft, and this conference is part of that, right? So,
yeah, I see pictures of Hanselman and Scott Hunter and Lady Gaga.
Yep. And more to come. We're going to be announcing more in very soon. I would love to say, but they're still finalizing them now. So I don't want to get myself in trouble, but yeah, there'll be some neat stuff there. And as part of that, also, we'll be announcing some things that we're doing with .NET Foundation to kind of broaden what we're doing for the community and stuff. So I'm excited about that. It's exciting, and it's also a lot of work to get stuff ready, but we've got some kind of neat things we'll be announcing there.
So John, do you have any other speaking engagements or any other exciting items that you wanted to announce here?
Well, let me see. Okay, so we've got .NET Conf at the end of September. I've got a Dev Intersection coming up later. I've got a short trip in the beginning of September. I'm going to Progressive.NET in London. And as part of that, I'm going to be swinging down to the Southeast.NET, which is in Brighton. So hope to see some folks there as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Six Figure Developer Podcast.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
That was John Galloway, member of the .NET community team and executive director of the .NET Foundation. This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I'm John Galloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.